Following a sustained decrease in the daily number of COVID-19 cases, the regional government scrambled to improve a plan to reopen the economy unveiled last week by increasing operating hours and adding concert halls to the list of businesses that can reopen.
We are very happy to be back to work and hope this is the last time we shut down because it will be the end for our business. I cried every day when I was out of work because I have a family to feed. We are worried. We can't fail this time.
Under the new guidelines, food service businesses are able to operate indoors at 30% occupancy, while they can serve at full capacity on terraces, provided they keep a 2-meter distance between tables. The 4-phase reopening is expected to last 2 months, with a gradual lifting of restrictions on movement inside of the Spanish northeastern region. A 10 p.m. curfew will stay in place for several weeks as the situation in hospitals and intensive care units remains critical. Meanwhile, authorities have launched massive antigen testing campaigns across the region in a bid to control the spread of the virus.
The antigen rapid test detects the COVID-19 virus using a nasal swab. It offers a highly reliable result within 15 minutes, and it is one of the most cost-effective tests on the market right now.
Although test sensitivity for rapid antigen testing is generally lower than for the standard PCR, authorities are pushing for their deployment, arguing they could be useful in detecting highly infectious people. With a population of 7.5 million, Catalonia has registered over 300,000 cases of COVID-19 and over 15,000 deaths since the start of the pandemic.
The reopening of the economy in Catalonia is fraught with its fair share of risk and reward for everyone involved. It will take at least 2 weeks to find out if the second shot at the virus was successful. The stakes for the food service, hospitality, entertainment and sports industries have never been higher. Kusai Kadri, Barcelona.
Some 120 kilometers from Srinagar, the summer capital of Indian-administered Kashmir, lies Uri. The line of control that divides Kashmir into two parts and ruled by India and Pakistan runs through this area of Baramulla district of Indian-held Kashmir. After trekking around 10 to 15 minutes, you reach the Smurthal village, which is frequently a target of India-Pakistan animosity. Parvez Ahmed's house was completely destroyed in the recent India-Pakistan face-off. Although his family was lucky enough to survive this devastating attack.
This is not new for the people who live near the LOC, but this time it was a rain of artillery. Years of my toil is wasted. I and my family of five are homeless now in this winter. The fire even burned the food stock that I had stocked up for the winter months.
Weeks have passed since the incident. Parvez is still waiting for help and relief work to begin.
We have repeatedly asked the government to build bunkers for the people living in this area. The government is not paying attention to our needs.
The Jammu and Kashmir administration is working on a project to construct 44 bunkers for people living along the line of control. They said that another project for building some 250 individual bunkers is underway.
Whenever we go to government officials with a request, they often turn us away. Many times they say, go and seek help from Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Whatever is being said about help and relief is a media stunt, a part of which might reach us but too late.
For decades, Kashmiris have been bearing the brunt of India-Pakistan animosity. The two countries have fought two of their three wars over Kashmir, which they rule in parts but claim in its entirety. Kashmir has lost tens of thousands of people after the armed struggle against Indian rule began in 1989. India accuses Pakistan of training and sending fighters into Indian side of Kashmir, something Pakistan denies but says it only supports the idea of free and unified Kashmir, politically and diplomatically. The question that remains is how long will Parvez and many others like Parvez wait for government's assistance? Can they survive this harsh winter without a proper shelter? And how long will it take the world to stand for the resolution of this long-pending dispute without further destruction? Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir. As the European Council is set to convene in December to discuss the tensions with Turkey, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has called for dialogue, but warned the EU not to become a tool for enmities during escalating tensions over the Eastern Mediterranean. In his latest statement on Turkey-EU ties, Erdogan said Turkey sees its future in Europe and mentioned Turkey's post-pandemic plans to improve judicial infrastructure and strengthen the economy and other reforms.
Bugün de kendimizi...
We see ourselves as an inseparable part of Europe, with which we share 600 years of historical bond. We are calling on the EU to create a closer bond with us, to keep the promise of full membership for Turkey. We see ourselves in Europe, not anywhere else. We aim to build our future with Europe.
Observers, however, say Turkey does not stand any chance to become an EU member, despite all negotiations.
In my opinion, the EU does not see Turkey either as a partner or a possible member of the bloc. For the EU, Turkey is only a trade ally. This means that neither now or in future, Turkey will not get closer to becoming an EU member.
Earlier this week, the EU's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, said Turkey isn't sending positive signals and needs to change its attitude fundamentally regarding the hydrocarbon dispute with EU members Greece and Cyprus in the Mediterranean Sea. European leaders say they will watch for Turkey's steps in the next couple of weeks before discussing any potential sanctions in their upcoming summit. Turkey is still a candidate to become an EU member. The bloc decided to effectively freeze accession talks in June 2018 over disagreements on accession terms. Many here are pessimistic about the future of accession talks, despite Ankara's ongoing efforts to meet the EU's demands. Meanwhile, some economists even warn that the accession could harm Turkey's economy. Rehşan Saglam, Istanbul.
Israel launched airstrikes in the early hours of Sunday on the Gaza Strip, causing damage to surrounding areas, but no casualties reported. Israel claims the airstrikes targeted Hamas positions and came in response to a rocket fired from Gaza toward the southern city of Ashkelon, the second time in 2 weeks.
Israel is not committed to its responsibilities, refusing to allow in the required ventilators for the enclave amid the coronavirus pandemic. The resistance front preserves the right to give a crushing response to those violations.
The Palestinian groups say they will continue their resistance as long as Israel is imposing its crippling blockade over the impoverished enclave, especially amid the coronavirus pandemic and the shortage of medical equipment and ventilators.
It is the resistance movement's duty to defend Palestinians against the Israeli aggression under any condition. Israel should be held accountable for the deterioration of the Palestinians' lives. This is a crime against Gazans.
Observers say Israel's refusal to meet the basic needs of Palestinians increases the possibility of further escalation.
The ongoing conflict comes as a result of Israel's suffocating siege on the Gaza Strip over the past 14 years. Palestinians won't remain silent. Through strikes like the recent ones, Israel is seeking to cover up its internal problems.
Israel has been conducting similar strikes on Gaza Strip over the past months.
The resistance groups here stress they are ready for any possible escalation, and the resistance will go on until the crippling siege on the Gaza Strip is broken. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
With almost 100,000 children under the age of 5 at risk of dying, Yemen slides into a dire situation. Here lies the 9-month-old Munir struggling to survive a severe malnutrition.
Munir Nabil.
This is my son Munir. We've been here for a week. We want to treat him for malnutrition, and God helps us. We're resisting this savage war.
The ongoing war and siege imposed by Saudi Arabia has brought a severe famine described by the UN as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world.
There is an increase in malnutrition cases. Yemeni children are suffering from malnutrition in all governorates, and we receive 50 to 60 cases per day. There is a shortage of medical equipment like CT scanners.
The UN's former humanitarian coordinator for Yemen described the country's food security status as catastrophic. Now, a UN analysis shows that the coronavirus pandemic, economic problems, and the war have pushed malnutrition the highest levels in some parts of the country. According to the UN study, malnutrition has risen 15% among children under the age of 5 this year.
We condemn and denounce the continued international silence about the blockade imposed on Yemen and the failure to take any measures against the Saudi coalition, which has exacerbated human suffering, especially for children.
Millions of children in Yemen could be pushed out of starvation by the end of the year as the humanitarian crisis is compounded by the ongoing war and the blockade, along with the pressure of funding shortage as the world grapples with the coronavirus pandemic. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A large number of people turned up in the garrison city of Rawalpindi near Pakistani capital Islamabad. These angry youngsters were outraged against India over its alleged unending brutalities against Muslims in disputed Kashmir region. So were they resentful against Israel for suppressing Muslims in the occupied Palestine.
Equally, these protesters are angry with the rulers of many Arab states over their alleged collaboration with India and particularly with Israel in strengthening their illegal hold of territories belonging to the Muslims. But it seems for these protesters, there is a leadership vacuum in the Muslim world.
This protest was organized by Youth Parliament, an organization of students of colleges and universities from all over Pakistan. They have been campaigning to forge greater unity among Muslims across their racial and sectarian profiling and regions. With greater unity among the ranks and files of Muslims, these students are struggling to bring an end to the atrocities being committed against Muslims by reviving the true spirit of Muslim nationhood all over the Islamic world.
We will never accept Israel. They are bombarding on the small children in the Palestine. They are Muslims. We are standing with them and they are looking for the Pakistan, that they should come for the help for the Palestine.
The protesters sounded disappointed with the Prime Minister Imran Khan, who won last general elections partially with the pledge to pursue Muslim causes. Muslim causes in the world appears to be what matters to the common people in Pakistan. The lingering public resentment against France over repeated publication of blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet of Islam is yet another cause these students have been fighting for. This protest has followed gathering of millions of people on the streets of eastern city of Lahore a few days ago. Such a huge crowd emerged to attend the funeral of Khadim Hussain Rizvi, a religious and political leader who through his sustained protest forced Prime Minister Imran Khan last week to ink an agreement with his government to expel French ambassador and officially boycott French products in Pakistan. Javed Rana, Rawalpindi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week. Imam's great initiative in naming Unity Week.
The Palestinian cause will continue to thrive, and the Zionist regime will be destroyed. One of the things that they have done is to establish relations with that murderous and criminal usurper, the Zionist regime. These terms truly describe the Zionist regime. It has usurped Palestinian lands, and it has murdered people. Just look how many Palestinians they have killed and what crimes they have committed. And they were happy at and proud of it, and they fabricated reasons for it. They justified it with ridiculous reasons. What I want to say is that many Muslim governments and many true addressees of the message did not unfortunately grasp the significance of Imam's initiative, but the enemy did. He understood how important our late Imam's recommendation to create unity among Islamic denominations and their general orientations, not in their beliefs, as everyone has their own beliefs and opinions, was for the Islamic Ummah.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
The enemy understood that unity would undermine his influence in Islamic countries. Because he understood it, he began to devise schemes against it. The enemy implemented plans of action to confront our magnanimous Imam's message of unity. For example, he established centers to produce anti-unity thought. We speak of bringing Islamic denominations close to one another. However, they established certain centers and hired some mercenaries to produce thoughts and ideas against the idea of bringing Islamic denominations close to one another. They demanded that the mercenaries do something to foil Imam's great policy and magnificent and divine measures, centers to produce thoughts. Another thing that they did was to create takfiri groups. It was the enemies of Islam who created that lethal group called Daesh. The Americans have acknowledged this. Of course, we had reliable information, but if we had spoken about it, it might have been doubted.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to
This is IRIB English Radio.
Come on. It's time to get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans. And muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Debate.
Protests have erupted in France over a new law that has proven controversial. It's over a new security law. The proposed legislation would criminalize the dissemination of images of police officers unless their faces are blurred. Those found guilty would be imprisoned or receive fines. Activists have denounced the law as a violation of press freedom. In this debate, we will ask whether this is the case and whether France is downgrading its definition of freedom.
On Tuesday, the lower house of the French Parliament gave its green light to the global security bill with an overwhelming majority. The law needs to be approved at the Senate and the French Constitutional Court before it can be enacted. It would legalize sharing images of police officers with malicious purposes. It would also require the faces of law enforcement forces be blurred upon publication. However, it grants further freedom to police to record ordinary citizens without their consent. Anyone found guilty of infringement could face a fine of up to €45,000 and 12 months in jail. Supporters of the bill say it protects officers and their families and that it does not undermine freedom. However, those claims have failed to convince others, as the legislation has faced a barrage of condemnations and outrage from a wide range of people and organizations. Opponents say the legislation erodes freedom of press. On Wednesday, clashes broke out between security forces and demonstrators protesting the bill in the city of Bordeaux. Thousands of people also rallied across the country, including the capital, Paris, against the proposed legislation.
We will no longer be able to film policemen in action and to put them on the social networks, which is of course very dangerous, because nowadays there is a real issue in France about violence from the policemen.
Amnesty International has lashed out at Paris for persisting with the bill, saying it sends a worrying message. The European Union has also expressed concern, saying Paris needs to ensure that journalists be able to work freely and in full security. The bloc has warned that it will examine the law to make sure it's in line with EU policies. In today's digital world, it's hard to imagine what would happen if people were stripped of the right to film potential injustices. In May, the publication of a video showing US police brutality against a black man sparked weeks of protests. The officer who killed the unarmed man was charged with second-degree murder and later discharged. Such a brutal incident may have gone unheard if it weren't for a passerby to record it on his mobile phone. The new French law takes away from people their minimal protection against police brutality, their freedom to film violence.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, political analyst and member of the Solidarity and Progress Party, Sébastien Perrimoni, joins us from Paris. We also have journalist and political analyst, Geoffroy Coleman, who also joins us from Paris. Gentlemen, welcome. Let me first start with you, if I may, Sébastien Perrimoni. Tell us why you think this case is deemed controversial and, as it has been described, a violation of press freedom.
Yes, it's not only the violation of the press freedom, you know. I see that France, which are known as the champion of free speech and of human rights, is now showing a new face. And this face is the face of repression and censorship. So it's a very bad news, not only for the press, but also for the people, as the woman was saying in the demonstration. Because, as you know, we have been a champion, yes, in a freedom of speech and a freedom of press, as we have seen recently with the Mahomet caricature, you know, and the right to blaspheme, as we say in France. So even, you know, what is very strong to understand that even all the editorial board of the major French channel and the major newspaper, BFM TV, TF1, Le Figaro, Libération, CNews, all the important newspaper and TV channels say that they are against, and they made a publication saying that they are against this Article 24 of the legislation because it will prohibit them, you know, to cover finally the brutality that is going on around France. So we had the law in France. The law is from 1881, which is the law of freedom of speech and freedom of press. And now we are entering now in 2020, so almost 120 years later, in a new period of censorship and repression and reduction of our liberty.
Okay.
It's very dangerous.
We're going to expand on that a little bit more, but Joao Coleman, let me ask you this. I mean, to get down to some of the nitty-gritty of this, it is said that this would limit the right to film or photograph on-duty police officers. Now, looking at that, doesn't that pave the way for officers to commit crimes and break the law while being immune to prosecution?
Of course. Yes, of course. I mean, the current restrictions on civil liberties, of course, are technically illegal. We have the right to assembly and the right to walk around and go about our work and about our business without being hassled by police. These are extreme measures which are being imposed not just in France but throughout Europe, and they are part of a transition towards a different type of society. The type of society they want to transition towards is a technocracy, and in a technocracy the individual has no more civil liberties and he's under 24-hour surveillance by cameras. We already have cameras everywhere in Europe, in every city, and they fear very much that the people will revolt. The restrictions on restaurants, bars, small businesses that have occurred again in the second lockdown mean that an entire class, essentially the middle class, is now becoming bankrupt. And an entire, the motor of the French economy, the motor of every economy in the world is the middle class, small businesses. They are being destroyed. They fear a social revolt. And of course, they know that if they don't give full powers to the police to repress that using whatever means necessary, the people will film them. And of course, that will go into social media. And so they're also trying to crack down on social media. They want to ban social media effectively and make it impossible for people to open up accounts on social media as well. So we're going into a new period of totalitarian control, essentially. And this is what the lockdowns are about. Lockdowns are completely useless in terms of protecting lives. We only have to look at Sweden to see that it's absolutely no impact on people's health. It's detrimental to people's health, mental and physical. It has nothing to do with public health. It is basically a transition to a new society, and that society is a technocracy. And that's very clear if you look at the global picture, if you look at the plans of Davos and the Great Reset. It's very clear if you read Klaus Schwab's book, for example, his recent book, that the kind of society they want is a society where there would be essentially no more society. It would be a technocracy where everything would be online. Of course, everything would be under surveillance. I mean, this is where we're at right now. So they fear also in France the consequences of the wide diffusion of a documentary recently, which got 6 million views and was seen by many, many people. They fear, you can hear them on the media talking about this all the time, the danger of conspiracy theories, the danger of thinking that there might be a conspiracy behind the lockdown. And of course, they sense that there will be a major social revolt, and probably a lot worse than the recent Gilets Jaunes. So remember, you had a massive rebellion against the state for over a year in France with the Yellow Vest movement that was repressed brutally by the police. And I think that they want to be able to repress the next rebellion with even further measures. So I think that's essentially what this is about.
Well, Sebastian, I'm hearing words like repression, totalitarianism, technocracy, social media restrictions, revolt. I mean, isn't France supposed to be a flag bearer of freedom after all, as the French
slogan or motto is Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité, French for liberty, equality, and fraternity. So I'm looking at the word liberty now being downgraded, is because that's what people are talking about, the French, in this respect. Is this the case, that this is being endangered?
It's not in danger if we fight. You know, I'm working with Jacques Cheminade, who was three-time candidate for the presidential election in France, and he has denounced for years, since the 1980s, the imposition of what he called a financial fascism. So it's true that if we want to maintain this financial fascism in the world, because we have to impose austerity, you need dictatorial power. So we have done that in South America, we have done that, I mean the West, have done that in Africa, pushing and putting in place dictatorial power to impose its austerity policy. So now is the turn of Europe. So of course, if we accept, because we have to fight for this liberty, and we have to fight for this fraternity, if we fight, we can save it. But it's true that if they want to go on with this financial austerity, this financial fascism, they will have to impose more stronger laws, you know, as the one we are seeing today, to control the revolt. Because as the other person mentioned, you know, since 2 years, now we have the yellow vest in France, so it's 2 years of demonstration. And from the beginning, you know, the confrontational approach of the government, they decide to have this confrontational approach, I mean repression in the street, was above all to dissuade people and the population to take part at this demonstration. Because at the beginning of the yellow vest, if you remember, we have thousands of people in the street saying, we don't want the privatization of our country, we don't want austerity, we need to have food at the end of the month, so it's not possible anymore. So now we are angry and we want to change the system. So, of course, you have a revolt against this system, and we are fighting with Jacques Cheminade and Solidarité Progrès, with other countries in the world, fighting to change, to have this new Bretton Woods system, a new financial architecture, because, and it's true, what Emmanuel Barroso was calling the European Union, we know, a non-imperial empire, as he was saying, which is a supranational institution imposing austerity on people. So the people don't want that anymore. They are fighting for that. And I think the question of the documentary was mentioned is quite dangerous, because, of course, half of the documentary is very interesting against the criminal responsibility of the government. But the other half is pushing people, you know, in irrationality and going after, you know, things which are not the real cause of the problem, which is the financial system and this financial oligarchy. So we have to focus, as the Yellow Vest was doing at the beginning, to go back to the monetary sovereignty of our country with a national banking system, with the Glass-Steagall, which means the separation of the bank in France, and of course the possibility to have our own credit system to reinvest in infrastructure, entrepreneurship, development, and so on and so forth. That's the main issue to fight for today.
Okay, well let's zoom in on this word revolt, Gerard Coleman, if we can look at this word and see what's happening. We're looking at a COVID-19 pandemic to have struck, obviously, many parts of the world, Europe no exception, of course, France also. Now, I'm going to ask your reaction to this particular headline, which is very alarming, that came out roughly a week ago. And it said, Europe's governments are losing control of COVID, and because of that, revolt is in the air. And it says that fears of civil unrest are growing as people across the continent no longer trust their leaders to protect them during the crisis. So do you think that maybe the French administration, headed by Macron, is foreseeing something like that perhaps happening? There have been protests in France. We've seen it in Italy, in Naples, where people were just fed up with the lockdowns. And maybe this is a way to make sure that the police is protected, since they are predicting, perhaps, that there's going to be revolts and protests, so we need the police out on the streets. Do you think this may be the case?
Well, they've certainly lost control of the narrative, the COVID-19 narrative. They've lost control of that, I think, because we now have thousands of scientists and doctors speaking out about it. And the consensus they wanted, the absolute consensus about what it is
and how dangerous it is, and therefore what they need to do. That has broken down because of alternative media, because of social media. There's been a massive amount of censorship of science during this entire debate, and we've had a monopoly in the media of people linked to pharmaceutical companies and pharmaceutical interests. And there's a huge pharmaceutical agenda, of course, behind the vaccine, which will make billions of dollars for these big companies. And as your guest said, it is a financial oligarchy, after all, and all these companies are linked to finance markets and high finance. So they do fear a rebellion against that. Of course, they won't be able to impose and make obligatory this vaccine, which is a new type of vaccine, extremely dangerous. It hasn't been tested before. They won't be able to impose that very easily. There's a lot of vaccine skepticism in France, and I don't think that in any case, we don't even know what COVID-19 is because it's never actually been isolated. So you cannot possibly vaccinate against something you don't really understand. And there is no need to vaccinate against it anyway, because it only kills people who are very, very old, and they usually die of other diseases as well. It isn't really killing people in the way they say it is. It's mostly people who have comorbidities. So I think what people fear, I would say, rather than this so-called pandemic, is the measures, the harsh measures that infringe on people's liberty. And if you fear COVID-19, then by all means wear a mask. If you fear COVID-19, then you should have the possibility of staying in your house forever. Why not? Maybe be able to work from home. But people who don't fear it should be allowed to live it normally, and it should not be prevented from going about their business, and they should not be forced to wear masks and forced to social distance and so on and so forth. And it is these top-down measures, really, which is making life impossible for people. I mean, life has become literally impossible. We now live in a dystopian nightmare. Nothing is open. You're not allowed to do anything, and you're not allowed to say anything. If you have to wear a mask all the time, you can't even have a conversation with people. So this has to stop. This nonsense has to stop. The narrative about COVID-19 is over. It's finished. The so-called pandemic has been over with months. So most of the scientists say, so there is no need to keep this up. But of course, it's not about public health. As I said, the aim of this entire agenda is to move towards a technocracy. And as Thatcher said, society doesn't exist. Society won't exist in a technocracy, and the family won't exist. Social structures won't exist. Social relations won't exist. And they want people in front of screens and iPhones. They want them connected to the Internet of Things, and it will be the big tech which will decide. And eventually, it will be people who are savvy in big tech who will be the controllers of society. And of course, high finance is the overall system we're talking about here.
Okay. When it comes to freedom, however, and rights, Sebastian, the French are known to make their voices heard. They're known for demonstrating. I mean, we've seen the French demonstrate throughout time, and they have demonstrated and they have earned the rights that they have fought for so hard. So, if it comes down to their freedom being restricted, if this is one of the levels that the government is going through, that perhaps could lead to other things, other restrictions or oppression. Don't you think that you're going to have an outburst of people who are going to come out on the streets? I mean, we've seen it with the Yellow Vests, what they have done. Perhaps we're going to see them again coming out and protesting this law. Do you think that is a possibility?
Of course, it's already going on. You have demonstration yesterday evening, with a lot of brutality, but from both sides, that's also one of the problems, is that big people are becoming violent in both sides, because everybody is angry, the policemen, because they have no money, they are not paid, they have to work 24 hours because you have demonstration all the time, and people who are not have self-sufficient economically. So you have kind of, with the disintegration of our economy by the financial institution, we have a kind of civil war, mass strike ferment in our country, which is very dangerous. So I think for the lockdown, it's not the same issue. Of course, the COVID, we have a lot of mistakes which have been made. For you take Sweden, for example, they are locking people down now because they wanted to to not do it at the beginning, so they have to do it now partially. But they st- so we cannot say that it's fake news all the time, because if you go in the hospital, what I have done in France, you go to the hospital, people are working 24 hours, you know, I mean, at least at the first lockdown, people were working very hard to save life all the time, you know. So the second lockdown was not justified, for sure, but the first one was not a fake news, as we can hear from some scientists. People are really dying. A lot of people have died, not only in France, but in the world. So
not
I think
really,
we have to,
really.
We have to temper what we are saying about this. And I want to say that the problem we have is not this crisis, is the financial disintegration of our system, and with this technocracy, as it was said, to impose financial austerity by all means, with the big pharma, with the GAFAM, with the Silicon Valley, with a mass surveillance system and control of the population. Yes, we have all this problem to fight together.
Thank you very much for that. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guests, political analyst and member of Solidarity and Progress Party, Sebastian Perimonida from Paris, and journalist and political analyst, Jehua Holman from Paris also. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Miko Batakwe, it's goodbye until next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ivanka Trump is among a growing number of President Donald Trump's close advisors who want nothing to do with his legal efforts to subvert the results of the November 3rd election, according to a new report. These advisors may publicly act as though they believe Donald Trump and his personal lawyer Rudy Giuliani can pull some kind of courtroom miracle to prove widely debunked claims of election fraud, according to the Axios website report. The article you're about to hear has been written by Jonathan Swan and Elena Treen, writing for the Axios website. The piece is titled, Ivanka Trump Distances Herself from Dad's Election Fraud Claims as Her Own Legal Jeopardy Grows. Stay with us for more of Jonathan Swan and Elena Treen's article. Ivanka Trump is among a growing number of President Donald Trump's close advisors who want nothing to do with his legal efforts to subvert the results of the November 3rd election, according to a new report. These advisors may publicly act as though they believe Trump and his personal lawyer Rudy Giuliani can pull some kind of courtroom miracle to prove widely debunked claims of election fraud, according to the Axios website. but talk to them privately, and many say Rudy Giuliani and his team are on a dead-end path. Even Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump think this is going nowhere, according to people who have spoken to Trump's daughter, Ivanka, and Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. According to Axios, Trump's close aides, who include Ivanka Trump, are averse to getting anywhere near Rudy Giuliani and his planned courtroom drama. Most hardcore Trump sources have psychologically bailed and are just waiting out the storm, Axios said. Meanwhile, Ivanka Trump, Trump's daughter, is facing the possibility of some courtroom drama of her own. A bombshell New York Times report on Thursday described how Ivanka Trump could be enmeshed in two separate fraud investigations by the New York Attorney General and the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. The investigations are looking into President Donald Trump's business dealings as head of the Trump Organization. Ivanka Trump was a vice president in her father's company before she joined his White House in 2017. The investigation by Attorney General Letitia James is civil, whilst the probe by District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr.'s office is criminal. Both officers have issued subpoenas to the Trump Organization in recent weeks for records relating to millions of dollars in tax deductions, the New York Times said. While there is no indication that Ivanka Trump is the focus of either inquiry, she denounced the investigations on Twitter as politically motivated harassment, pure and simple. This inquiry by New York City Democrats is 100% motivated by politics, publicity, and rage. They know very well that there's nothing here and that there was no tax benefit whatsoever. These politicians are simply ruthless, Ivanka Trump claimed. The records requested followed recent reporting in the New York Times, which are based partly on 2 decades' worth of Trump tax filings. The filings show that the president reduced his company's income tax liability over several years by deducting $26 million in consulting fees as a business expense. Those fees were paid to unidentified consultants on numerous projects between 2010 and 2018. Records suggest that $747,622 of those fees were paid to Ivanka Trump through a company she co-owned when she was also a Trump Organization executive, the New York Times reported. On a 2017 disclosure she filed when joining the White House as a senior presidential advisor, she reported receiving payments from the consulting company totaling $747,622, the New York Times reported. That amount exactly matched consulting fees claimed as tax deductions by the Trump Organization for hotel projects in Hawaii and in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. It appears that Ivanka Trump was treated as a consultant whilst also working as an executive for the Trump Organization, which made the payments. CBS News reported that this situation wouldn't necessarily pose a legal issue for Ivanka Trump as long as she paid income tax on the consulting payments. It could, however, raise questions about whether the Trump Organization's related tax deductions were allowable, CBS News added. The Internal Revenue Service, IRS, has been known to pursue civil penalties over large consulting fees write-offs it found were made to dodge tax liability. The 2 investigations are related to allegations made in news reports and by Trump's former lawyer Michael Cohen that Donald Trump had a history of inflating the value of some assets to impress banks and business partners, but lowering the value when seeking tax benefits, according to CBS News. We'll be right back.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.